House of Suns by Alistair Reynolds. Narrated by John Lee. Copyright 2008 by Alistair Reynolds. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Alistair Reynolds and United Agents, and was produced in the year 2009 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Part 1. I was born in a house with a million rooms, built on a small airless world on the edge of an empire of light and commerce that the adults called the Golden Hour, for a reason I did not yet grasp. I was a girl then, a single individual called Abigail Gentian. During the 30 years of my childhood, I only saw a fraction of that vast, rambling, ever-changing mansion. Even as I grew older and gained the authority to wander where it suited me, I doubt that I ever explored more than 1/100th of it. I was intimidated by the long, forbidding corridors of mirror and glass, the corkscrewing staircases rising from dark cellars and vaults where even the adults never went, the rooms and parlours that, although the adults and housekeepers never said as much in my presence, were alleged to be haunted, or in some way not convivial to anything other than transitory occupation. The elevators and dumbwaiters alarmed me when they moved, without apparent instruction, obeying some inscrutable whim of the house's governing persona. It was a mansion of ghosts and monsters, with ghouls in the shadows and demons scuttling behind the wainscoting. I had one true friend, although I cannot now remember his name. He arrived occasionally, but only ever for short visits. I would be allowed to watch the approach and docking of his private shuttle, viewing it from the airtight vantage of a glass-windowed belvedere perched above the mansion's highest tower. I was always pleased when Madame Kleinfelter allowed me up to the belvedere, and not just because such an occurrence signalled the arrival of my only true companion. From there I could see the entirety of the house, and much of the world on which it was built. The house curved away in all directions until it met the sharp bend of the planetoid's jagged horizon, a thin margin of rock marking the limit of my home. It was a strange building, although for a long time I had nothing to compare it with. There was no organized plan to it, no hint of symmetry or harmony, or if there ever had been, that underlying order had been lost beneath countless additions and alterations, work that was still ongoing. Though the planetoid had no atmosphere, and therefore no weather, the house was designed as if it belonged on a world where it rained and snowed. Every distinct part of it, every wing and tower, was surmounted by a steep-sided blue-tiled roof. There were thousands of roofs, meeting each other at odd, unsettling angles. Chimneys and turrets, belvederes and clock towers punctuated the haphazard dinosaur-backed roofline. Some parts of the house were only 1 or 2 stories high. Others had 20 or more levels, with the tallest parts rising like mountains from the foothills of surrounding structures. Windowed bridges spanned the gaps between towers, a silent distant figure occasionally stealing behind their illuminated portholes. It was less a house than a city in which you could walk from one side to the other without ever stepping outside. Later in life I would learn the reason for my home being the way it was, the reason why the building work never ceased, but as a child I simply accepted it unquestioningly. I knew the house was different from the ones I saw in books and story cubes, but then nothing in those books or cubes resembled any significant aspect of my life. Even before I could read, I knew that we were rich, and it had been impressed on me that there were only a handful of other families whose wealth could be compared to our own. "You're a very special young lady, Abigail Gentian," was what my mother told me on one of the many occasions when her ageless face addressed me from one of the house's panes. "You're going to do great things with your life." She had no idea. It did not take me long to realize that the little boy must also be the child of a rich family. He came on his own ship, not one of the company-owned liners that occasionally conveyed lesser mortals to and from our planetoid. I would watch it arrive from deep space, slowing down on a spike of cobalt flame before stopping above the outer wings of the house, pirouetting into a landing configuration, flinging out skeletal landing legs and lowering with elegant precision onto the designated touchdown pad. Our family symbol was a black cinquefoil. His was a pair of intermeshing cogs, the emblem painted on the ship's sleek, flanged hull. As soon as the shuttle was down, I would rush from the Belvedere, almost tumbling down the tightly wound spiral stairs threading the tower. Whichever clone nanny was looking after me that day would take me to one of the elevators, and we would travel up, down, and sideways until we reached the docking wing. We usually got there just as the little boy was coming out, taking hesitant steps down the long, carpeted ramp from his ship, with two robots gliding alongside him. The robots scared me. They were hulking things of dull, weather-worn silver, with heads, torsos, and arms, but only a single huge wheel in place of legs. Their faces consisted of a single vertical line, like an arrow slit in a castle wall, at the leading edge of a fierce wedge-shaped skull. They had no eyes, no mouth. Their arms were segmented and ended in three clawed hands, good for nothing except crunching flesh and bone. In my imagination, the robots were keeping the little boy prisoner when he was not visiting me, doing horrible things to him, so horrible that he could never quite speak of them even when we were alone. It was only when I was older that I grasped that they were his bodyguards, that deep within the dim architecture of their minds was something perilously close to love. The robots only came to the bottom of the carpet, never rolling off it onto the wooden reception floor. The boy would hesitate, then step off, shiny black shoes clicking on the varnished blocks. His clothes were black except for white cuffs and a wide lacework collar. He wore a little backpack, and his black hair was glued back from his brow with strong-smelling lacquer. His face was pale and slightly pudgy, with round dark eyes of indeterminate colour. "Your eyes are funny," he always told me. "One blue and one green. Why didn't they fix that when you were born?" The robots would spin around at the waist and reverse back into the shuttle, where they would wait until it was time for the boy to leave. "It's hard to walk here," the boy always said, his footsteps unsteady. "Everything's too hard." "It feels normal to me," I said. It was a long time before I realized that the boy came from a place in the golden hour where the local gravity had been fixed at half standard, which meant he found it difficult to move around when visiting the planetoid. "Father says it's dangerous," the boy said as we made our way to the playroom, two nannies trailing behind.
"What's dangerous?"
"The thing inside your world. Or has no one told you about that yet?" "There's nothing inside the world but rock. I know. I looked it up in the story cube, after you told me there were snakes living in the caves under the house."
"The story cube was lying to you. They do that when they think you need to be protected from the truth."
"They don't lie."
"Then ask your parents about the black hole. It's under your house right now."
He must have known that my father was dead, and that I could only ask my mother something when her face appeared on one of the panes.
"What's a black hole?"
The boy thought about this for a moment.
"It's a kind of monster, like a giant black spider hanging in an invisible web. Anything that comes too close, it grabs them and stings them and then eats them alive. And there's a very big one under your house."
Thinking I was being clever, I said, "So what happened to the snakes? Did it eat them?"
"I lied about the snakes," the boy said insouciantly, "but this is real. Ask the story cube about black holes if you don't believe me. Your family had it put under the house to make everything heavier. If it wasn't there, we'd be floating now."
"How can a spider make things heavier?"
I said, "It's like a spider, not that it really is one."
He gave me a pitying look. "It's a sucking, hungry mouth that you can't ever fill. That's why it pulls everything in towards it, making us feel heavier. But it's also why it's dangerous."
"Because your father said so."
"It's not just father. The story cube will tell you everything if you ask it the right questions. You can't just come at it headlong. You have to go in sideways, like a cat stalking a mouse. Then you can fool it into telling you things it isn't meant to. A black hole swallowed up a whole planetoid once, bigger than this one. It swallowed up the planetoid and everyone living on it. They all went down the plug like water after a bath. Glug, glug, glug."
"That won't happen here."
"If you say so."
"I don't believe you anyway. If you weren't telling the truth about the snakes, why should I listen to you now? Quite suddenly, the malice vanished from his face. I felt as if my friend had only just arrived. The teasing, spiteful boy who had accompanied me until now had just been an impostor. Have you got any new toys, Abigail? I've always got new toys. I mean, anything special. There is something, I said. I was looking forward to showing it to you. It's a kind of doll's house. Doll's houses are for girls. I shrugged. Then I won't show it to you. Echoing the words he had spoken to me earlier, I announced, I said it's a kind of doll's house. Not that it really is one. It's called palatial. It's like a castle you control with its own empire. It's a pity. I think you would have liked it. But there are other games we can play. We can play in the mood maze or the flying room. I could be manipulative as well, and I had already gained some dark insights into the boy's mind. I knew that he would feign indifference for at least part of the afternoon, while his curiosity to see the doll's house was burning a hole right through him. And he was right to be curious, for the doll's house was the toy I was most eager to show off. With the nannies in tow, I brought the little boy to the playroom. In the dark, shuttered, gloomily lit room, I rolled out boxes and trunks and unpacked some of the things we had played with on his last visit. The boy shrugged off his backpack, undid the top flap, and pulled out some of his own favorite toys. There were things I remembered from his last visit. A scaly-winged dragon that flew around the room, spitting pink fire, before landing on his arm and coiling its tail several times around it. A soldier who would hide himself somewhere in the room when we closed our eyes. It had taken us hours to find him the last time. There were marbles, little glass balls cored with whirls of color, which rolled on the floor and organized themselves into shapes and figures according to shouted commands, or formed shapes which we then had to guess at before they were complete. There was a puzzle board and a lovely machine ballerina who would dance on anything, even the tip of a finger. We played with these things, and eventually the nannies brought us lemonade and biscuits on a floating trolley. Somewhere in the house, a long case clock chimed. I want to see the doll's house now, the boy said. I thought you didn't want to see it. I do, really. So I showed him palatial, taking him into the room within a room where it was kept. And although I revealed only a fraction of its capabilities, he was fascinated by it. And I knew even then that he was jealous, and that palatial would be the first thing he would want to see on his next visit. It was the first time I had felt him in my power. I decided that I liked the feeling very much. Chapter 1. I lifted the glass of wine, already drunk on the scenery before a drop had touched my lips. To the future security of your civilization and solar system, Mr. Nebulae.
To your civilization, Purslane said from the other side of the table.
Thank you, said Mr. Nebulae. We were sitting by the beach, enjoying wine on a warm evening. Nights on the Centaur's world was not the same as on most planets. Since the world orbited a star heavy in ultraviolet radiation, Scapers had thrown a protective bubble around the atmosphere, a transparent shield that the Centaurs tolerated, as opposed to the armored shell that would have been necessary if the House of Moths had moved their solar system. By day, the bubble served only to screen out the rays and take the edge off that scalding blue brilliance. By night, it amplified the faintest star or gas cloud until the hues were intense enough to trigger the color receptors in the human eye. The Milky Way was a luminous, many-boned spine, arcing from horizon to horizon. A nearby supernova remnant was a smear of ruby red, dulling to sable at its curdled edges. The pulsar at its heart was a ticking lighthouse, an open cluster of blue stars, no more than a few hundred lights away, spangled like a clutch of electric gems. The dwarf stars within a few lights of this system were warm ambers and golds, promising life and sanctuary and the 10 billion-year stability of a slow fusion cycle. Even the absence was visible, that thumb-sized smudge of starless, galaxyless darkness in the direction where Andromeda used to lie. The sky was beautiful, as luscious as a drug-induced vision. But I did not care to be reminded of the absence. It brought to mind my promise to Dr. Menix. the promise I had so far failed to keep, and which now hung by the slimmest of threads. My only hope was that the centaurs would come through.
"And you're absolutely certain that the Stardam won't give us any cause for concern in the future, Shatterling Campion?" asked the four-legged being standing at our table. "You can rest easy, Mr. Nebulae. Your civilization is safe again."
"Not that it was ever in grave danger," Purslane said, swelling the wine in her glass. "Let's be clear about that."
I smiled. "A leaking Stardam's not something you can ignore, but the fault is repaired. We installed it, we'll fix it if it goes wrong. That's how we do things in Gentian line."
"You can understand why we're concerned. When the other survival options were presented to us, it was emphasized that repairing the Stardam involved the minimum of risk."
"And it did," I said. 1.5 million years ago, a supermassive star within 11 lights of the Centaur's world had grown unstable. Rebirthers had attempted to siphon matter from the star's core using wormhole taps, but the fierce densities and temperatures had thwarted the throat-stabilizing devices that held the wormholes open. Scaper intervention could not protect the Centaur's biosphere. That left only 2 other options, apart from evacuation of the system. Melictaline, the House of Moths, were experts in the movement of stars. They offered to relocate either the star or the system, promising to accomplish either task for free, provided they received exclusive trading rights with the Centaurs for the next 2 million years. Neither option was without risk. The point of moving a star was to eject it out of the galactic disk before it had a chance to explode. But the very act of movement had occasionally led to premature detonation. And while the Centaur system could be moved, their planet would need to be encapsulated against interstellar radiation and debris for the duration of the voyage. This was deemed unacceptable by the Centaurs, who had a horror of claustrophobia. At this point, Gentian Line, the House of Flowers, had made the Centaurs' acquaintance. Seeking prestige within the commonality, we offered them the option of remaining where they were and being protected from the ailing star. A star dam would be erected around the supergiant. When the star blew up, its energies would be contained within the dam, trapped forever inside a screen of perfect mirrors. The Centaurs were naturally skeptical, but Gentian Line could point to some experience in this matter. If it had any specialization within the commonality, it was in star dams. We had been making them for dozens of circuits, millions of years. At the time of the Centaur negotiations, no Gentian star dam had ever collapsed. We could only take so much credit for this, of course. We made the dams, but all we really did was put together the ready-made components left behind by the Priors. They had done all the hard work. They forged ring worlds in their millions, large and small, then threw them like hoops around stars. Then they abandoned them and became extinct. 1 billion or so years later, we began to collect them. We scour space for the occluding signatures of orphan starless ring worlds. We fix pushers to their dark sides and launch them across the galaxy at miserable, snail-like fractions of light. It must be done with care, lest the structures shatter into 1 trillion twinkling fragments. Ringworlds are immensely strong, but they are not indestructible. What they are is shiny. In fact, there is nothing shinier in the known universe. That mirrored inner surface reflects everything, including neutrinos that would happily sail through 50 light-years of solid lead. To dam a star, to enclose it completely, would require the construction of a Dyson shell. Humans can shroud a star with a swarm of bodies, a Dyson cloud, but we cannot forge a sphere. Instead, we approximate one by surrounding a star with thousands of ring worlds, all of similar size, but with no two having exactly the same diameter. We make a discus, and then start tilting, until each ring world is encircling the star at a unique angle. The light of the star rams through the narrow gaps as the ring worlds tighten into their final orientation. Shutters close on a fierce, deadly lantern. Then suddenly there is no star, just a dark sphere. Inside that shell, the energies of the dying star are held in reflected fury, allowed to bounce back and forth between those flawless reflecting surfaces until, photon by photon,
They gradually leak out into space at a harmless intensity. It takes an unthinkably long time. Should the star dam collapse before most of that pent-up energy has been allowed to dissipate, the results would be more disastrous than the explosion the dam was designed to contain. I had exaggerated when I said that we had saved the local civilization, but that was not to say there had not been a problem with the star dam. One of its pushers, the engines that keep the ringworlds in check, had begun to fail. An eye-shaped gap had opened in the dam, allowing furious light to burn through. I had been sent to repair it. A new pusher had followed Dalliance from the last reunion, tailing my ship like a loyal puppy. In my hold was the string of linked brass spheres called a single-use opener, a device keyed to that specific star dam, which permitted limited adjustments of its nested mechanisms. Before visiting the Centaurs, I had deployed the opener. It had shattered into glittery dust after emitting its graviton pulse, and installed the new pusher. Over the course of several days, the eye had closed, the dam sealing over again. Our work here was done. Purslane thought the decent, honorable thing would have been to leave without contacting the Centaurs, without soliciting their gratitude. She was right, beyond any measure of doubt. "You were right to pick the star dam," Purslane said, doubtless aware that she was talking to the distant descendant of one of the creatures the line had first done business with. "But you're also right to express disappointment that the fault arose in the first place. You expected better of us." Mr. Nebulae scuffed a hoof against the ground. No great harm came of it. "Regardless, you have the line's apology, and our assurance that nothing like this will ever be permitted to happen again." Purslane was making no secret of her being a Gentian shatterling as well. Though the line frowned on the practice of consorting during circuits, our hosts had a well-earned reputation for discretion. "In the meantime," she continued, "if there's anything else Gentian Line can do for your civilization, I'll be glad to raise the matter at the next reunion. You've been gracious hosts, beyond anything we deserve. The arrangements you've made for our guest, Dr. Menix." "Speak of the devil," I said, lifting a pair of antique binoculars from the table. "Is that him now?" asked Mr. Nebulae. "One and the same." "He's traveling in a most curious contraption. What are those circular things along the side turning round?"
"Wheels," said Purslane. "It's his bathing machine," I said.
The bathing machine was a rust-streaked black rhomboid mounted on four sets of independent undercarriage. It had emerged from the hold of my ship, descended the loading ramp, and made its ponderous, plodding, smoke-belching way from the landing area, through the low, shuttered buildings of the sleepy seaside town, to the cracked concrete of the ancient revetments above the beach. Negotiating a steep slipway, it had crossed the sands and entered the water, continuing until the machine was submerged up to the depth of its wheels. At the front, a single door folded up onto the roof of the machine and allowed seawater to slosh inside. The sea was the midnight blue of ink, awash with shimmering microorganisms. The waves foamed pink and cerise when they dashed against the chrome-white sands. I leveled the binoculars at the seaward end of the bathing machine, hoping for a clear glimpse of Dr. Menix as he emerged into the sea. Disappointed, all I saw was a barnacled form slipping away from the machine, vanishing beneath the surface before I could make out more than the rudimentary details. The door closed, and the bathing machine crept back out of the water. "Might I ask how you came by such an unusual specimen, Shatterling? It's been a very long time since we saw the likes of Dr. Menix, several hundred thousand years at the very least."
"I can't take any credit for him. He was foisted on me."
"You make it sound like a punishment."
"It was. The rest of my line felt it would give me ample opportunity to demonstrate that I could shoulder responsibility and put up with a difficult guest."
Purslane said, "It was Campion's bad luck, Mr. Nebulae. Gromwell, another Shatterling, showed up at our last reunion with Dr. Menix as a guest. By then, Gromwell was looking for any excuse to fob him off onto someone else. That was around the time that Campion threaded a strand that happened to include a visit to the Vigilance."
"You know all about the Vigilance," I said.
Mr. Nebulae looked to the sky, in the approximate direction of the absence. He wore a tight-fitting pinstripe suit that reached down to the point where his human torso merged seamlessly with the groomed chestnut of his horse body.
This and that, Chatterling, which is not to say we've ever had direct contact with them.
Purslane sipped her wine.
The thing is, it turned out that Dr. Minix's ultimate goal was to reach the Vigilance. Apart from being a staunch disavower, he fancies himself a scholar of remote history.
Which is how Campion came to be burdened with the Doctor's presence, Mr. Nebulae said.
In addition to monitoring the Stardam, I was told to ferry Dr. Minix to the Vigilance and use my contacts there to secure him privileged scholar status, unrestricted access to the Deep Archives, that kind of thing. They don't much like disavowers, and they definitely don't like aquatics, but it was assumed I'd be able to talk them around.
Mr. Nebulae flexed his torso to look out to sea again, a thoughtful expression appearing on his face. One can only conclude that you were not entirely successful in that venture, Chatterling.
No, everything's still on track, I said. Since this was the Doctor's last chance for a swim before the Vigilance, he jumped at it. I second Purslane's thanks for making the necessary arrangements, by the way.
The Centaur waved a dismissive hand at the twinkling barrier on the horizon, beyond which Purslane's hovering ship, much too large for the landing area, rose like a tarnished silver moon. It was nothing. There are no large predators in this ocean, but for your guests' peace of mind it was a simple matter to establish the impasse across the bay. I just hope we adjusted the salinity to his tastes.
The conversation lulled. Mr. Nebulae had not come up to our table to pass the time of day. He was here to tell me what value he placed on the items I had offered for sale. Much depended on his offer, though I was doing my utmost not to let him know it.
"It was good of you to open your trove for examination," Mr. Nebulae said.
I nodded encouragingly, while Purslane maintained a tense diplomatic smile.
"I hope you found something of interest in it."
"I found much of interest in it. You have travelled far, traded intelligence with other starfarers and amassed a great deal of knowledge, much of it of considerable rarity. It was a privilege to sift through your data."
"And did you find anything in there that you might like to purchase?"
Mr. Nebulae shifted on his iron-shod hooves. "I did find several things, Chatterling, but I must confess that much of what you have to offer is not of direct value to me, despite its rarity. If you had arrived 20 kilo years ago, things might have been different. But it is only 11 since we were visited by a Chatterling of Gentian line, and only 2 since a Marcelin was in our airspace."
"Those Marcelins get everywhere," Purslane said through tight lips.
"The items that did interest you?"
"I have a breakdown here," the Centaur said, reaching into a pocket of his business suit to remove a handkerchief-sized square of material. He flicked it open and it enlarged to the width of our tabletop. He let it hang in the air, where it hovered against the breeze. It was a series of tabulated columns, in the written variant of tongue. The Centaurs had been known to Gentian line for more than 8 circuits. They were the 13th form of human to live in this system, having emerged from the post-civilizational ruins of the last culture. They owned this system and the handful of scaped worlds inside it, but had never ventured further than their cometary halo. Their world was a panthalassic, a super-oceanic planet smothered in water, with a thick blue atmosphere containing photo-disassociated oxygen. Scapers had thinned out that atmosphere and made it less corrosive, dropped floating land masses onto the world enveloping sea, and scattered a multitude of hardy pelagic organisms into that sterile ocean. The planet's gravity had never been adjusted, which was why the Centaurs had attained their present sure-footed form. They had a dim recollection of where they had come from, which was more than could be said for all post-mergents. According to the statistical forecast of the Universal Actuary, they stood an excellent chance of persisting for at least another 1 or 2 million years, providing their ambitions remained modest. In the long run, the best strategy for cultural longevity was either to sit tight in a single system, or become like the Lines, entirely unshackled from planetary life. Expansionism worked for a while, but was ultimately futile. Not that that stopped new emergents from trying, even when they had 6 million years of sobering history to mull over.
"We called it T," turnover, the endless grinding procession of empires. The centaurs had done well not to climb onto that wheel.
As you can see, Mr. Nebuli said, our offers are not unreasonable.
No, your terms are very generous, I said. I was just hoping you'd bid for some of the larger items in the trove.
I wish that were possible. Unfortunately, there would be little sense in bidding for data we already possess.
Are you absolutely certain we can't find some middle ground?
We are inclined to generosity, Shatterling, but there have to be limits. We feel that these terms are fair. It's a shame that your trove does not contain more of value to us, but that does not preclude you from visiting us again when you have something new to offer.
The centaur paused, three of his hooves in full contact with the ground, the rear left touching only by its tip.
Would you like a moment alone to discuss our offer?
If you wouldn't mind.
I shall return shortly. Would you like some more wine?
We're fine, I said, raising a hand.
Mr. Nebuli turned and trotted away along the curving road that lay on this side of the revetments. In the distance stood two other centaurs, dressed in red uniforms and carrying the pennanted staffs of some civic guild. Mr. Nebuli joined his compatriots and watched us patiently.
We're doomed, I said, not really caring if my words were intercepted.
Purslane finished off her wine. Could be worse. He's prepared to offer you something.
Not enough to make a difference.
Parked in orbit around the centaur's world was an assortment of second-hand ships, most of which were up for sale. If Nebuli had liked enough of the data in my trove, he could have made me an offer sufficient to buy one of those vehicles. With a faster ship, I could have kept my promise to Dr. Menix and made it back to the reunion only slightly later than anticipated. I suppose I could hold out. See if he changes his mind.
He'd have to change it a lot. He could double his offer, and it wouldn't buy you a quarter of one of those ships. The best thing we can do now is take Mr. Nebuli's money. You can't replace Dalliance, but you can still upgrade some of her systems.
It won't make her faster.
I'd settle for safer if I were you. If you turn him down, we might as well never have come here. We could have gone straight to the Vigilance and got Fish Face off our backs.
It was as if Dr. Menix had heard Purslane, for as she spoke, the bathing machine bellowed its engine and began to labour back into the sea, clouds of filthy smoke emerging from slats in its rear. I watched as the door swung up and water sluiced in. I half considered raising the binoculars again, but my curiosity had dissipated. The barnacled form crested the waves momentarily and vanished back into the bathing machine. The door clammed down and the machine began to crawl back onto dry land.
There's another possibility, I said quietly.
Purslane looked at me with practiced skepticism. There always is, where you're concerned.
Before we landed, I had a look at the nearby systems, just in case Mr. Nebuli wasn't as forthcoming as I'd hoped. Less than 100 lights from here, and more or less on our way home, is a place called Nelumbium. According to the Trove.
According to the Trove? Where have I heard that before?
Hear me out. There's supposed to be an entity, a post-human, called Ateshka. He's supposed to have ships, a lot more than Nebuli, and he's unlikely to charge us steeply.
Why didn't we go there first?
The Trove entry isn't as up-to-date as I'd like, so there's an element of uncertainty.
An element? I've heard that before as well.
Also, it would have taken us even further from the Vigilance. If we'd gone straight to Nelumbium, there'd have been no possibility of dropping off Dr. Menix.
If the Trove isn't up to date, what's to say Ateshka's there at all?
I ran the actuary. The prognosis looked good.
Purslane leaned back in her wickerwork seat, measuring me with those mismatched gentian eyes.
So what you're proposing is, you limp to the Vigilance, deliver the doctor, then continue to Ateshka.
Actually, no. What I'm proposing is, I skip the Vigilance completely.
The hard notch of a frown ached into her brow.
Leave him here.
The choice'll be his. If he wants, I'll take him all the way back to the reunion world.
He won't like it.
He doesn't like anything. Haven't you noticed? A thin figure was stalking across the sand from the direction of the bathing machine. As the walker neared, climbing the crumbling steps up to the road, it revealed itself to be a paper cutout of a harlequin, inked in watery chevrons. The two-dimensional figure, which resisted the breeze just as effectively as Mr. Nebulae's hanging sheet, was a humanoid avatar of Dr. Minix. At the same time as the avatar approached, Nebulae left the red-suited centaurs and started trotting back in our direction. He arrived first, the avatar still a good 100 meters away. "Might I assume that you've reached a decision, honored Shatterling?" he asked.
"I'm afraid I'm going to have to turn you down," I said. "I'm not saying your terms aren't generous, but I have to be realistic. I think I can get a better deal for my trove somewhere else."
"If you are thinking of Ateshka, I'd caution against it. He has a very bad reputation."
I scratched sand from my eyes. "Ateshka? Who's he?"
"Merely a warning, Shatterling. It's up to you whether you heed it."
He brushed his hands against the breast of his pinstripe suit.
"Well, I am sorry we could not close a deal, but it won't stop us parting as friends. We are very happy that you visited our world, and I trust your stay here has been rewarding."
"It has," Purslane said. "You've been excellent hosts, Mr. Nebulae. I'll be sure to put in a good word for you with the rest of the line."
"That is very kind of you."
He turned around to greet the approaching avatar, bowing slightly from the point where his human torso joined his horse body.
"You finished your swim very quickly, Doctor. I trust all was satisfactory."
"No,"
the avatar said in his high-pitched, piping voice. "The swim was very far from satisfactory, which is why I aborted it at the earliest opportunity. There were things in the water, dark, moving things that my sonar could not easily resolve, and the temperature and salinity were not at all to my tastes." The paper face bent in my direction.
"I was given to understand that you had communicated my needs to the relevant authorities, Campion. I see now that I was in error."
I shifted on my seat. I had told the centaurs what the doctor needed, and I had no doubt that they had done their best to meet his requirements. Nothing was ever good enough for Dr. Menix, though. No effort ever sufficient.
"I'm sorry," I said. "I must have mixed up the figures. All my fault, I'm afraid."
"I shall lay the blame where I choose to lay it," the avatar said. "And I was so looking forward to my swim. But what's done is done. Shortly I shall take my leave of this dreary world and continue my odyssey to the Vigilance. Perhaps they will know the fit way to treat a guest."
"I'm sure Mr. Nebulae did his best," I said.
"Yes, he probably did,"
the avatar said, as if our host was not present. The moment, the one I had been dreading since Mr. Nebulae had delivered his verdict on my trove, was now upon me. I could postpone it no longer. Though at that instant there was nothing I would rather have done than walk into the sea and swim all the way to that twinkling horizon, where, depending on the effectiveness of its setting, the impasse would have dissuaded, rebuffed, stunned, wounded, or simply annihilated me.
"Dr. Menix," I said, after drawing a deep, invigorating breath, "there's something we need to discuss."
Chapter 2. It would be a mistake to say that Campion was lazy, laziness being a trait that Abigail went out of her way to scrub from our personalities. But Campion was certainly a masterful prevaricator. He did not just put things off until tomorrow. He put them off for tens of kilo years, until his delays and evasions consumed significant chunks of an entire circuit. His motto might have been, "Why do today what you can still do in a quarter of a million years?" He had got away with it for 31 circuits, too. But now this business with Dr. Menix was going to make up for that glorious streak of good luck. Campion joked about censure and excommunication, as if to immunize himself from those outcomes. But the line's tolerance of his antics had been wearing perilously thin for several circuits, which is why he had been saddled with Dr. Menix in the first place. He should have discharged that obligation as urgently as possible, instead of dilly-dallying from star to star with the doctor still aboard. It was a short hop from the Centaur system to Nelumbium, barely 90 years of flight by planetary time, but it was still necessary to enter some form of abeyance. Campion preferred stasis. I, much to his incomprehension, preferred to be frozen and thawed. As soon as the cryophagus released me, I called up the information from Silver Wing's sensors, and apart from a whisper of residual energies, which might mean only that a ship had passed through this system in recent centuries, there was no evidence at all of human habitation. No Ateshka, no ships. Once I had digested Silver Wing's analysis, I whisked over to Dalliance, then up ship to the bridge, where Campion and Dr. Menix were already waiting for me. Campion was seated, reclining back in one of the couches, while the Avatar stood close to him. They were both facing the enormous illuminated wall of the displayer. Although I could not make out their words, the acoustics of the bridge were such that I could tell they were lost in quiet, slightly strained conversation, a petulant or defensive note rising every now and then. I did not need to be told what they were talking about. Most of the displayer was filled with a plan view of the Milky Way, based on the Trove's knowledge of real conditions. The spirals were traced with wispy filaments of white and yellow, ochre and tan, and dulling fire-brick orange, with the individual stars too countless to separate, discernible only by their groupings into associations, streams, and clusters. The only stars one saw as distinct entities were the very brightest, end-phase supergiants burning their way to supernova, or Tauri-phase youngsters glaring out of that barred spiral in hot blues and venomous reds. The main disk, excluding the outer band of the Monoceros ring, was 90,000 lights across. Settled worlds spread from the core to the outermost extremities of the spiral arms, but the highest density of human inhabitation was in the thick band of the comfort zone, the region where planets required the least adaptation to make them livable. Provided it stayed within the zone, a ship could circumnavigate the galaxy in 200 kilo-years and still have time to stop off at 100 systems en route. That was a circuit, the 200-kilo-year interval between Gentian reunions. The last reunion world had been a planet on the coreward extremity of the Norma spiral arm. Since then we had travelled clockwise, looping out to cross the local spur, passing within 1,000 lights of the old place, then diving back through the Sagittarius, Scutum Crux, and Perseus arms, before returning to the other side of the Scutum Crux arm. A wavery red line traced our progress. The centaurs, Panthalassic, had been in Scutum Crux, and the distance we had travelled since then was barely a scratch against the scale of the spiral, not even enough to take us out of the arm. Marked in dashed red was the distance we still had to travel to make it to the reunion. It was less than 1,000 lights in the direction of the Sagittarius arm. In circuit terms, we were nearly home. Yet, as far as our punctuality was concerned, it may as well have been 10,000 lights, or 90,000. We were going to be late, very late, and that was very much not the done thing.
"Ah, here comes the lovely Perslain," said Dr. Menix, his voice rising to a note of shrill indignation. "She will lend a sympathetic ear to my complaints, even if you choose not to, Campion. Is that not so, Perslain?"
"I don't know, Dr. Menix. What exactly are you complaining about?"
"Need I explain?" the Avatar said, raising a limp origami arm in the direction of the displayer. "Once again, Campion has let me down. Not only did he fail to deliver me to the Vigilance, not only did he attempt to fob me off on those stinking ill-mannered horse people with their revolting bodily habits, not only did he stand by as I nearly drowned in their horrid flotsam-infested bay, but now he has the temerity to tell me that I will not even return to the reunion in time to be entrusted to someone else's better care."
"I didn't say that," Campion replied, sounding like a man drained of argument. "All I said was that we might be just a tiny bit late."
"And this reunion of yours, they will delay starting it until you have arrived?"
The Avatar's tone was needling.
"Is that what you are telling me?"
"I can't make any guarantees. If Ateshka's here, and if he agrees to replace my ship, we might not be very late at all."
I walked across the narrow tongue that connected the main part of the bridge to the circular platform, where Campion and Dr. Menix were waiting.
"So where do you think he is?"
"I don't know. Hiding or something," Campion said.
Dr. Menix pounced. "Oh yes, hiding. That well-known business model embraced by profit-conscious traders the galaxy over."
I smiled. "At least the view's nice.
Ateska's world, shown beneath the map of the galaxy, was an outrageous confection of a planet, a striped marshmallow giant with a necklace of sugary rings, combed and braided by the resonant forces of a dozen glazed and candied moons. We were crossing the ecliptic, so the rings were slowly tilting to a steeper angle, revealing more of their loveliness. There was no doubt that it was one of the most glorious worlds I had ever seen, and I had seen quite a few. But we had not come here to gawp at a picturesque planet, even if it was a spectacular exemplar of the form. "Did you get anything I missed?" Campion asked. I kissed Campion, then took one of the unoccupied couches. There were some hints of technological activity, but nothing you'd bet your life on. Maybe a ship came through with a noisy drive, or perhaps I'm just seeing some leakage from the private network of another line. We don't appear to have a functioning node in this system.
I'll make sure we leave one. It might be the kind of thing that will placate Fescu.
I'm afraid it'll take rather more than that.
I notice it's all right when he's late.
I pressed a finger to my brow, feeling a throbbing between my eyes. Don't start on about Fescu again.
We all had to wait in abeyance until he deigned to arrive. How long was it? 7, 8 kilo years easily. I didn't see him getting censured.
That's because Fescu had been invited by the Rebirthers to witness a kindling. He couldn't leave until it was finished, as you well know. Your situation is very different.
Go on, kick a man when he's down.
Perhaps I should entrust myself to Purslane instead, Dr. Menick said. That way I might at least get back to the reunion before it finishes.
You know, that's not such a bad idea. Why don't both of you leave now and I'll catch up when I'm able?
As if I'd ever do that, I said, shooting an apologetic glance at the Avatar. Sorry, Dr. Menick, but I can't abandon Campion here.
There'll be repercussions.
And you're still my guest, Campion said.
More's the pity.
Indeed. And wouldn't it be a tragedy if something happened to you between now and the reunion? Something obscure and undocumented, like a sudden breakdown of tank chemistry? Can't be too careful, you know. That apparatus already looks as if it belongs back in some museum of horrors from the Golden Hour. It's just begging for something to go wrong with it.
The paper figure's face creased in anger.
Are you threatening me, Shatterling?
No. Just indulging in a little wishful thinking.
Things might have taken a turn for the worse at that point, had Dalliance not chosen to interrupt with a report. Someone, something, was signalling our two ships. A vehicle had emerged from the atmosphere of the giant, near its lusciously banded equator, a vehicle that had been completely hidden until that moment, but which was now keen to announce its existence.
"And to think you doubted me," Campion said.
The other vessel was reassuringly old-fashioned, a solid, reliable example of 11th intercessionary shipbuilding. It was all severe angles and dark, lustrous facets, like a mountain-sized lump of coal chiselled into the shape of an arrowhead. It had continued to signal us since its emergence, sending a single repeating transmission in tongue. There had been no need to respond. The message had simply instructed us to decelerate from our trans-ecliptic trajectory and await further instructions. The vessel curved past the ring system without penetrating it, and came to a dead stop in the local reference frame defined by Dalliance and Silver Wings of Morning. The three ships formed an approximate equilateral triangle, with only 1,000 kilometers between their centers of mass. Campion's ship was an Art Deco rhomboid, mine a headless chrome swan with wings curved and raised as if in courtship.
"Now what?"
I asked.
"We wait and see. Ateshka, whoever he is, probably hasn't had much company lately. I don't think he's going to be particularly bothered about keeping us waiting a bit longer."
I touched a finger against the side of my head. It had felt a shivery, someone walking over my grave sensation. Silver Wings has just been scanned with deep penetration sensors.
"Attack him now!" shrilled Dr. Menix. "Why are you waiting? Attack him immediately!"
"Dalliance is requesting permission to realize an imago," Campion said.
"Nothing ventured," I said. A hooded figure resolved into existence before us, rendered with just enough translucence and artificial flicker to affirm that this was a projection, not a physical presence. The voice, slow and deep and sonorous, was modulated to sound as if it had passed through a primitive transmitting apparatus.
State your business here, dalliance and silver wings of mourning.
The figure spoke a variant of tongue, the only thing approaching a universal language for star travelers. I'm looking for someone called Ateshka, Campion said, using trans, the private language of the commonality of lines, trusting dalliance to translate his outgoing message into tongue. He could speak tongue as well as I could, but preferred to let the ship do the hard work.
I ask again, what is your business here? Why have you arrived in this system?
I need a new ship, Campion answered. I was led to believe I might find one here. The figure hovering before us wore a hooded gown of dark red material, patterned with fine chrome wires in the branching forms of ancient circuitry. His hands were clasped, but otherwise hidden under voluminous sleeves. Of his face, nothing was visible under that dark, sagging hood.
A ship?
He asked, as if it was the last thing in the world Campion might have been looking for.
Why would you want a ship, traveler?
Mine's getting a bit worn out. I had the sense of something staring at me from under the hood, something with superhuman acumen.
Do you see many ships here, traveler?
They're not exactly leaping out at me, no.
In which case, it would appear that you have come to the wrong place, would it not?
Except my trove says otherwise, Campion said. Now, if you hadn't popped out of that Jovian, I might have put it down to faulty data. But your arrival is a coincidence too far. I am speaking to Ateshka, aren't I?
What would your trove have to say about this Ateshka?
Very little. His prices are said to be fair, and apparently he has a large assortment of used vessels. But if he sells ships, that's really all I need to know. The sleeves fell back to reveal thin white wrists, and even thinner white fingers, curiously jointed and tipped with obsidian nails. The hands reached up to throw back the hood. Ateshka's face was a ghoulish mask, gauzy white skin papered over a hollow-cheeked skull. His eyes were set deep into shadowed sockets. His teeth were jagged chips of blood-red glass, pushed into his gums at irregular angles.
I might have some ships.
Campion looked at me before answering. Can we see them?
Follow me. I will show you what is on offer.
I do not trust this man, said Dr. Menix. I insist that we leave immediately.
My thoughts flicked back to the warning Mr. Nebulae had given us. It was like touching a raw nerve. Campion, I said, maybe we ought to think. Ateshka's ship wheeled around and accelerated back towards the gas giant. Exotic particles twinkled into existence in its wake as tortured, addled space-time relaxed back towards its normal tension. Stars and one edge of the ring system blurred, as if seen through moiled water.
We're going in, Campion said.
Chapter 3. At the last possible instant, Ateshka's ship threw an impasse around itself, as armor against the atmosphere as it plunged into the cloud deck. Dalliance's impasso was less effective, and we experienced moderate buffeting as the aerodynamic forces increased. Purslane grimaced and muttered something about how we should have gone in her ship instead. Silver Wings was standing watch in orbit, monitoring our descent. Ateshka took us 100 kilometers into the clouds, disengaging his parametric engine and using sequence field rippling to swim through the air. That was a trick Dalliance had not been capable of for about 10,000 years. I switched from pseudo to real thrust. Above us the sky had lightened by degrees to a pastel azure, streaked with horsetails of fine white cirrus. A couple of moons were visible as delicate crescents, but the shadowed rings were hidden. Below us, billowing ochre thunderheads elbowed their way through a mustard-colored smog, rent here and there to reveal plunging vistas of cloud and chemistry, reaching down into dizzy, canyon-like depths hundreds of kilometers beneath us.
I think Ateshka could be taking us for a ride, Purslane said.
Let's wait and see what he has to show us.
Ateshka took us deeper. Dalliance protested against the increase in pressure, her impassors straining to support the bubble, but I had subjected her to worse conditions, and I had every confidence that she would hold.
Purslane had eased into the chair next to mine, buckled in against the stomach-churning surges caused by Dalliance's lagging acceleration damper. We nosed through those ochre thunderheads, our abrupt passage triggering a chain of electrical storms behind us. For a few moments we were in the mustard smog, losing all sense of onward motion. Then we cut through into a pocket of clear air, suffused with silvery gloom of the sunlight that made it through the overlying cloud layers. That was when we saw the collection of ships Ateshka had for sale.
"Please tell me I'm not seeing what I think I'm seeing," Purslane said.
"I wish I could."
"There were more ships around the Centaur's world."
"I warned you not to trust this man," Dr. Menning said. "It was clear from the outset that we were dealing with a charlatan with nothing to offer but second-hand junk."
There were 12 ships. They were suspended in the atmosphere, each floating in a neutrally buoyant impasse bubble. The ships varied in dimension from the same size as Dalliance, 5 or 6 kilometers in length, to vessels in the same medium-sized class as Silver Wings of Morning, 20 or 30 kilometers from end to end. One dagger of a ship was a full 50 kilometers long. Its red and white dazzle markings identified it as a Redeemer needlecraft. It looked impressive, but most of that ship would have been taken up with propulsion and field-generating equipment, with only a few cubic meters of living space somewhere near its middle. Nearly as large, and much more impressive, was the densely patterned golden sphere of a second Imperium moonship. It was hollow, with openings at either pole. There was room within a moonship for a city of 1 billion souls, or the treasure of 1,000 worlds. But moonships were enticing targets for less scrupulous travelers, and it suited me not to have to keep looking over my shoulder. Very much at the other end of the scale, Ateshka's smallest ship was a 2,200-meter-long fluted cylinder, seemingly hewn from turquoise-veined marble, its somber lines and unornamented hull establishing it as a Magravine artifact. Such a ship, assuming it was in good order, would have both excellent acceleration and a very high cruising velocity. But the mental modifications I would have to endure just to survive aboard it, let alone operate it, were of the kind expressly forbidden by the rules of the line. That left 9 other ships, but most of them could be dismissed at a glance. Too slow, too ancient, too vulnerable, too difficult to obtain the spares when some non-regenerative component broke down. A Rimrunner vehicle looked to have some possibilities, faster than Dalliance, easily, but then I noticed the telltale fuzziness at the boundary of her flotation bubble, indicating that her impassors were approaching life expiration. A 5-kilometer-long skullcraft of the Canopus sodality was also briefly tempting, until I remembered how those ships had a well-earned reputation for murdering their occupants. A trimaran of the Perpetual Commonwealth had novelty value, but the field spars linking the 3 hulls together imposed a very low acceleration ceiling on the ship. Getting anywhere quickly had not been a priority for the citizens of the Perpetual Commonwealth, who had fondly imagined that their empire would endure unchanging for millions of years. That, unfortunately, was the extent of Ateshka's collection. 12 relics, not one of which came anywhere near what I wanted.
"Take your time," Ateshka's imago told me. "Feel free to examine the offerings at your leisure, if one might be so bold. How much are you hoping to spend?"
"It doesn't matter, Ateshka. I'm afraid I'm just not interested in any of these ships."
"Let us not be so hasty, traveller. There is much we can discuss. I don't even know which civilization sent you, and we're already about to say our farewells."
Then he raised his head, cocking it to one side as if an idea had just occurred to him.
"If none of these ships take your fancy, might it not still be possible to come to a mutually agreeable arrangement? An upgrade, perhaps. I can sell you a replacement engine or field generator, a new suite of weapons or sensors."
"Strip from one of these clapped-out derelicts?"
"Not at all. I maintain a modest collection of spare parts inside the moonship. All are of impeccable quality."
He linked his hands together again, bowing slightly. The white face shaped an inviting grin.
"Why don't you tell me what you have for sale, and then we'll take a look at the wares?"
Purslane leaned over to whisper.
"I'm not sure about this. You came looking for a new ship, not spare parts.
Shouldn't you stick to the plan?
Let's see what he has, I said. Maybe we can salvage something from this after all.
Traveler.
I'm not going to open my trove until we know there's something worth haggling over, I told the Imago. But I can give you an idea of what's in there. Sensorium epics from the War of the Local Bubble, none of which are in general circulation. Technical documents and appendices from the machine people. 7 logically consistent explanations for the absence. My account of a trip to the Vigilance, and the time I spent inside the digestive system of one of the curators. A map of the Emporium worlds, before the forced migration. Any of that tickle your fancy?
Most definitely, Ateshka said. Please, come inside the moonship. I am sure you will find it most interesting. Are you familiar with the relics of the Second Imperium?
Listen that.
Then you must not let this opportunity slip. Come, let us see what trinkets await you.
Ateshka's ship touched and then penetrated the impasse of the moonship, a widening circle of blue-white energy delineating the interface of the two fields. Once within the impasse, he doused his own generator and moved to a position above the northern pole. The richly patterned skin of the moonship curved down into the pole, suggesting that those patterns flowed onto the inner surface. I did not know. I had never been this close to a moonship. Ateshka's ship would barely fit into the northern hole. There could only have been a few hundred meters of clearance on either side of the 10-kilometer-wide aperture as his vehicle passed inside. I followed him without incident and came to a halt just to the rear of his faceted black ship. Golden light bathed us from all directions. A vast number of objects of various sizes and forms floated all around us, soaked in that opulent radiance.
"See anything you like?" Ateshka asked. "Over there, to your left, we have the engine of a forger cloud, Shepherd. To your right, Sycorax armoring modules. Seen some use, but still as good as the day they were made."
I had begun to answer him, to say that I needed time to look around, but that I was optimistic of finding something, when his ship vanished.
"This always looked like a bad idea," Purslane said.
Ateshka's Imago had vanished as well. We were alone on the bridge. I urged dalliance forward, but as soon as my ship tried to move, she reported unacceptable stress levels and went into an emergency drive shutdown.
"We're trapped."
"I noticed," Purslane said.
I looked at her with an exaggeratedly sweet smile. "Any constructive suggestions beyond saying we wouldn't be in this mess if we'd used your ship?"
"If this is how Gentian Line takes care of its guests, I should hate to be its prisoner," said Dr. Menix.
"What we do to prisoners," I said, "you don't want to know. Hold on, both of you. I'm taking her to the wall." The engine got louder, and then louder still. It screamed at us, even though the engine was in fact silent, even at maximum output. It was all down to ancient recordings piped through to the bridge. Purslane had never quite approved of that melodramatic touch, but I think even she was grateful for the indication that the engine was doing its utmost. It was not good enough. The ship began to shake, the console warning me that the engine was about to punch its way right through the hull and out the other side. I instructed the ship to abandon her efforts. The drive note died back down to a purr and then to a sullen, reproachful silence. After a long silence, I said, "Ateshka, are you listening?"
"He won't answer," Purslane said. "He's already got what he wants, your ship and everything in it."
"I demand that you shoot our way out," Dr. Menix said.
Purslane turned to him.
"We're in a moonship, held in place by a force field. I suggest you give some thought to the likely consequences of using weapons in this situation."
The Avatar said nothing, but stared at her with peevish resentment, as if she was somehow responsible for the objection she had raised.
"Mind if I have a word with him?" Purslane asked.
"Be my guest if you think he'll answer."
She pulled the console closer.
"Ateshka, this is Purslane, the owner of Silver Wings of Morning. I hope you're listening, because what I'm about to tell you is of great importance. I had my doubts about your little operation from the moment you popped out of the atmosphere. Big enough doubts that the last thing I did, before allowing Campion to carry me into this trap, was to send an order to my ship.
If she doesn't hear from me within a period of time I've no intention of disclosing, Silver Wings is to head away from this system at emergency acceleration. I looked at her with an expression that said I sincerely hoped she was telling the truth. Knowing Purslane, it was quite likely. "Shall I tell you about the other order I gave my ship, Ateshka?" she went on. "She is to pulse a detailed message into the private network of Gentian Line. Yes, Campion and I are both shatterlings. That didn't even cross your mind, did it? If it had, you wouldn't have wondered which civilization we were from." After a moment, Ateshka's figure reappeared. "Anyone could make this claim. But I am making it, and I am Gentian. You should have been more alert, Ateshka. You saw two ships and thought, they can't be shatterlings, because shatterlings always travel alone. Most of the time you'd be right, too. But Campion and I are not your normal run-of-the-mill shatterlings. We consort. That means we travel as a pair, and it means you are in unimaginably deep trouble."
"You have given me no reason to believe you are Gentian."
"I'm about to. In the meantime, I want you to think about what it means to make an enemy of us. There may not be 1,000 of us anymore, but there are still 880, not including the two of us. That's 880 enemies you don't want to make. Enemies who not only know the location of your system, but who also have access to some of the fiercest weapons ever invented."
"Threats mean nothing without proof."
"I know. And that's why the line has taken pains to enable any member to establish his or her authenticity. I know from the data in Campion's trove that a Gentian shatterling visited this system only a few 100,000 years ago. That shatterling, her name was Mimulus, revealed herself to you with a password left by a previous member of the line. Upon her departure, Mimulus left you with another password, a word of her own choosing, which she then registered with the private network. Since no shatterling has visited you in the meantime, that password remains valid." Purslane took a theatrically deep breath. "The word is Passacaglia."
There was a silence. The gowned figure hovered before us, its face frozen in a deeply inscrutable expression. This was just the form he chose to adopt for the purposes of entrapment. He might have looked similar, or he might have been embodied as a city-sized intellect floating just above the liquid hydrogen ocean that lay beneath the lowest clouds.
"You could have learned that password," he said. "You could have intercepted and interrogated a Gentian shatterling, or broken into their private network."
"Or we could be exactly who we say we are," Purslane said. At last a flicker of doubt crossed the mask.
"Perhaps there has been a degree of misunderstanding."
"More than a degree, Ateshka. The question is, what are you going to do about it?" Dalliance lurched slightly as the field relinquished its hold. Cautiously I applied power, half expecting to be pinned down again, but we were free to move. I cleared the southern pole of the moonship, emerging back into the vacuum bubble surrounding the vast spacecraft, and then reactivated my own impassor before slipping back into the crush of the Jovian's atmosphere. "We're waiting," Purslane said.
"Might we soothe matters with a generous discount?"
"It'll take more than a discount. The gift of a ship might begin to cut it." "But there aren't any," I started to say. Purslane shushed me. "Then we'll talk about the people, crews and passengers of the other ships."
"The people?" Ateshka asked vaguely.
"Let's get something straight. If I even begin to sense that you're not telling me the whole truth, I'll send an order to my ship telling it to alert the line immediately." He shot back a hasty smile.
"Just seeking clarification, shatterling."
"Then let's be clear. There were people in those ships. You might have killed them, but I'm guessing you opted to keep them alive, or at least in abeyance. It wouldn't have cost you anything, and you'd always have the option of selling them on down the line. Civilizations will pay a lot for minds stuffed full of ancient memories." "How many are we looking at?" I asked.
"I took good care of them," Ateshka said.
"You can prove that by showing them to us," Purslane told him. "Bring them out, as many as you can."
"That will take a little while."
"No one's going anywhere in a hurry. When you're done with the people, we can discuss the other ships."
"The other ships?"
That thing I was saying to you just now, about not keeping anything from me?
Of course. The other ships. I was going to get to those.
I whispered, what other ships?
Wait and see, Purslane hissed back.
It took a while, as Purslane must have known it would, but I do not think Ateshka could have arranged matters any faster if he had wanted to. The people were stored in ones, twos, clusters of three or more, and much larger aggregations. Each unit, whether it held one or 100 individuals, consisted of an armored, independently powered shell, equipped with abeyance mechanisms and a small impassor, not large enough to swallow a ship, but sufficient to protect a sleeping capsule. Floating in the atmosphere after being liberated from the belly of the moonship, the units were a cloud of glassy baubles, each with a differently colored and shaped trinket at the heart. Some of the units were very ancient, while others were of a design and antiquity completely unfamiliar to me. They reminded me of the marbles in the playroom, in the family house in the golden hour.
Are there any line members here? I asked.
Gentian line, honored Shatterling, in so far as one is aware, no.
And other lines? Did you dupe anyone else?
I believe there may be some members of other lines, Chancellor, Tremaine, Parison, and Zoriel amongst them, although one cannot, of course, vouch for their provenance.
I shivered, realizing what a startling bounty I was about to receive. The liberation of members of other lines, Shatterlings who might already have been presumed to be victims of attrition, would inflate the prestige of the Gentians by a huge margin.
Have the line members, and anyone you think might be a line member, moved into the hold of my ship. There'll be room if the impassors are turned off as soon as they enter Dalliance's own bubble.
And the others? Purslane cut in. What are we dealing with? Nascents? Lost starfarers from turnover cultures, I presume?
Ateshka's voice quavered on the edge of some perilous truth. For the most part.
Here is what you'll do, I said. Take whichever ship is large enough to hold all the subliminals. Pack them inside, with enough support machinery to keep them in abeyance until they get somewhere. Then send that ship away, programmed to stop in promising systems, until they all find somewhere to live. We'll be keeping an eye on that ship.
Of course, of course, Ateshka replied, as if this was all perfectly reasonable.
Now let's see the other ships, I said. Purslane raised a finger. Wait a second. Who haven't we accounted for, Ateshka? If we've cleared out the lines and the turnovers, who does that leave behind? And remember what I said about the consequences of holding anything back.
I sensed vast hesitation in his voice. There is one. He has been in my care for some considerable while.
We're listening.
His name is Hesperus. He's an emissary of the machine, people.
I shook my head in astonishment. You trapped and imprisoned a member of the machine people, and you're still alive.
It was a simple mistake. Hesperus was posing as a biological traveller, so that he might journey unobtrusively. Had I known his true nature, I would never have detained him. Needless to say, once I had announced my intentions, I had no choice but to follow through. I could not let Hesperus return home.
Because you fear the machine people even more than you fear the lines, Purslane said, and rightly so.
You wouldn't want us as enemies, but getting on the wrong side of the machine people, that doesn't bear thinking about.
You've been playing with fire, I said. Now give us Hesperus, before you make things any worse for yourself.